नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Going to read this morning from Canto 9, Chapter 10, verses 4 through 7. There's no purports for these verses, but they're summarizing. So, Ramchandra's pastimes, we read yesterday, Shukadev Goswami declaring to Maharaj Parikshit that he was going to, at his being requested to do so, he was going to narrate Ram's pastimes according to the version of Maharshis, only in brief, and as you see, it's really only in brief. Part of the potency of these brief messages, it's something like a number of our Goswamis have written little summaries of Krishna's pastimes, just mentioning Sanatana Goswami did this and Jiva Goswami did, just mentioning the pastime, not the detail. And it's something like a painting. And once you know the pastime, just seeing the painting, you think of the whole pastime. So it's like that. The whole pastime isn't elaborated, but just in a phrase or a sentence, within your mind, the pastime appears, and the feelings of devotion for Ram awaken again. And so this is the methodology that's being applied by Vyasadeva. So as you hear, just think of the full pastime, not just the little sentence that's being presented. And it moves like a river. So starting with text 4, Shukadev Goswami recites, to keep the promise of his father intact, Lord Ramachandra immediately gave up the position of king and, accompanied by his wife, Mother Sita, wandered from one forest to another on his lotus feet, which were so delicate that they were unable to bear even the touch of Sita's palms. The Lord was also accompanied by Hanuman, the king of the monkeys, brackets, or by another monkey, Sugriva, because the verse just says a monkey. Anujabhyam, accompanied by the king of the monkeys, either Hanuman or Sugriva. And by his younger brother, Lord Lakshmana, both of whom gave him relief from the fatigue of wandering in the forest. Having cut off the nose and ears of Shuparnakha, thus disfiguring her, the Lord was separated from Mother Sita. He therefore became angry, moving his eyebrows and thus frightening the ocean, who then allowed the Lord to construct a bridge to cross the ocean. Subsequently, the Lord entered the kingdom of Ravana to kill him, like a fire devouring a forest, May that Supreme Lord, Ramachandra, give us all protection. Text 5. In the arena of the sacrifice performed by Vishvamitra, Lord Ramachandra, the king of Ayodhya, he wasn't king yet, killed many demons, rakshasas, and uncivilized men who wandered at night in the mode of darkness. May Lord Ramachandra, who killed these demons, in the presence of Lakshmi, be kind enough to give us protection. Texts 6 and 7. O King, the pastimes of Lord Ramachandra were wonderful, like those of a baby elephant. In the assembly where Mother Sita was to choose her husband, in the midst of the heroes of this world, he broke the bow belonging to Lord Shiva. This bow was so heavy that it was carried by 300 men. But Lord Ramachandra bent and strung it and broke it in the middle, just as a baby elephant breaks a stick of sugar cane. Thus, the Lord achieved the hand of Mother Sita, who was equally as endowed with transcendental qualities of form, beauty, behavior, age, and nature. Indeed, she was the goddess of fortune, who constantly rests on the chest of the Lord. While returning from Sita's home, after gaining her at the assembly of competitors, Lord Ramachandra met Parashuram. Although Parashuram was very proud, having rid the earth of the royal order 21 times, he was defeated by the Lord, who appeared to be a Kshatriya of the royal order. So, there's no purports for these, and I thought I would, just hearing about that particular pastime of encountering with Parashuram, I really like it. So we're going to read, hopefully I can find that section. Yeah. Page 45. Oh, look at this. Okay. The verse that we read, text 6 and 7, describe the marriage with Sita, and then when returning to Ayodhya, the encounter with Parashuram. So after the breaking of the bow and the in-principle betrothal of Sita by offering the garland around the neck of Ram, Vishvamitra celebrated, saying, immediately call for Dasarath to come, the whole royal family from Ayodhya came, and I'll just read. Dasaratha was again astonished to hear of Ram's divinity. He still found it hard to believe, having raised Ram as his child. He looked at the sun who stood before him modestly with bowed head and folded palms. Dasaratha was overpowered by love. His loving sentiments overcame any thoughts of Ram's divinity. The emperor looked again at Janaka and said, this marriage in every way, perform the ceremony under the guidance of learned brahmanas. O king, the success of a gift depends upon the way it is given. Therefore, be sure that all the necessary rites are properly observed without loss of time. Dasarath wanted to ensure that the marriage ceremony was performed carefully according to scriptural codes. He did not want any ill fortune created by neglect of sacrificial rituals, sacred rituals. Such errors would blight the marriage and recreate future difficulties for the couple. Janaka issued instructions to his ministers and then sat with Dasarath in the great palace hall. Both of them listened as Vashishtha recited Ram's family lineage. After hearing of Ram's ancestry, beginning with the sun god, Janaka recited Sita's genealogy, describing his own ancestry, which began with Lord Brahma. When Janaka finished, Vishvamitra spoke. He suggested that Sita's sister, Urmila, wed Ram's brother Lakshmana. The sage also advised that Janaka's brother, Kushadvaja, allow his two daughters to marry Bharat and Shatrughna. Then there could be one ceremony for all four marriages. Rising from his seat with joy, Janaka said, "Let it be so," again and again. He fell prostrate before Vishvamitra and said, "I am ever your servant. Your words are worthy of my worship, and I stand commanded by you. Let the wedding take place tomorrow, a day marked by favorable stars." As the two kings sat talking together, the sun gradually set. Janaka took his leave from Dasarath and departed for his personal quarters, thanked his ministers and 100 warriors. Thousands of golden oil lamps lit up the hall as the crowd of Brahmins made their way out, all of them constantly uttering auspicious Vedic hymns. So then the wedding takes place. We'll skip that part. So it mentions the four brothers and the four queens. Cries of happiness filled the pavilion, while the gods played their celestial drums. Bevies of apsaras danced and gandharvas sang. The sages recited Vedic hymns, and the blast of conch shells was heard everywhere. All those present in the assembly were lost in ecstasy. The ceremony ended at midday, and the kings and priests gradually retired to their tents, headed by Dasarath, Janaka, and the four newly married couples. The following day, Vishvamitra, after taking permission from both Dasarath and Janaka, left for the northern Himalayan range, his mind intent on performance of asceticism. Janaka bestowed upon his daughters a dowry consisting of hundreds of thousands of cows and an equal number of elephants, horses, chariots, and foot soldiers. The king, whose wealth was virtually unlimited, gave away millions of pieces of silken and cotton textiles, tens of thousands of hand-woven carpets, heaps of gold, silver, and jewels, and hundreds of richly adorned maids for each of the brides. Then there's a break. So now it's leaving Ayodhya time, leaving for Ayodhya. After a few days, Dasarath left for Ayodhya, proceeding at the head of a large army. As the king surrounded by his sons and the host of sages, was traveling along the broad road that led to Ayodhya, he suddenly saw a strange omen. Birds began to cry out fearfully and swoop low over their heads. Witnessing this foreboding sign, Dasarath's heart quivered and his mind became fearful. The king asked Vasishtha if he knew what was the cause of these omens. "These omens portend some grave danger," replied the rishi. "But here are our group of deer crossing our path from left to right. This indicates our deliverance from that danger you should not fear." All we need in our life is to have some deer cross from the left to the right. Everything will be all right. A fierce tempest blew up. The sky was enveloped in darkness, and the sky became black. Trees crashed to the ground, and the earth shook. A dreadful dust storm swirled around the travelers, confounding their senses. They were rendered virtually unconscious. Suddenly, from out of the darkness appeared the terrible sage Parashuram. He was dressed in tiger skins and had matted locks coiled at the crown of his head. Dasarath and his followers immediately recognized him. Although a brahmana, Parashuram was famous for his prowess as a fighter. In former ages, he had single-handedly overcome the world's warriors, annihilating them by the millions. The sage had become enraged when his father was killed by warrior kings, and he wreaked an awful vengeance. He had ranged the globe, massacring the entire warrior class. He now stood before Dasarath, holding a battle axe in one hand and in the other a fierce arrow which resembled a streak of lightning. He was as tall as two men, and he had upon his shoulder a great bow, appearing as irresistible as fire of universal destruction. He blocked the path like an impassable mountain. The sages in Dasarath's party quickly gathered together. They took water to wash Parashuram's feet and hands and offer him gentle words of welcome. Accepting the honor offered by the sages, Parashuram looked at Ram and said in a grave voice, "Oh, Ram, I have heard of your strength. By breaking Shiva's bow, you have performed an incredible feat. How can I, who has formed a great enmity with all warriors, tolerate hearing of such prowess existing in a king? I have here another sacred bow, that of Vishnu. Let me see your power now. Fit this celestial arrow, bow, draw it to its full length. If you are able to accomplish this task, then I shall challenge you to a single combat. When you stand on the battlefield and are swept away by the force of my weapons, you shall earn undying fame." Dasarath threw up his hands in horror. Knowing well of Parashuram's power, he feared for Ram's life. He approached the sage with joined palms and entreated him to spare Ram. Paying no heed at all to the king, Parashuram continued to speak only to Ram. "Both the bow broken by you and this one here were constructed by the architect of the gods, Vishwakarma. The one you sundered formerly belonged to Shiva. However, this one was Vishnu's property. It is thus more powerful than the one you broke, for Vishnu is always Shiva's superior." Parashuram took the bow from his shoulder. With furrowed brow, He gazed at Ram with bloodshot eyes, not immediately recognizing the prince's divine identity. This bow has been passed down from Vishnu to my ancestors and finally to me. I now offer it to you, O Ram, considering your sacred duty as a warrior to always accept a challenge. Exhibit now the strength of your arms. Parshuram held out the enormous bow. Ram, smiling slightly, stepped forward. I have heard of your tremendous feat in fighting and killing all the world's warriors 21 times, avenged your father with this commendable act. Even as a child, Ram had been told the story of Parashuram. The many kings killed by the sage had become debauched, and it was by divine arrangement that they had been annihilated. As the sage, Parashuram performed much asceticism and had finally been personally empowered by Vishnu himself, by dint of Vishnu's own desire and power, Parashuram had been able to exterminate the warrior class. Now Vishnu, appearing as Ram, again stood before the sage. He continued to speak. You are a Brahmin sage and are therefore worthy of my worship. However, since you despise me, seeing me to belong to the warrior class, I shall now display to you my personal prowess. Ram seized the bow, along with the blazing arrow from Parshuram's hand. He strung the bow in an instant and drew the arrow back to his ear. Looking angrily at Parshuram, he asked, Where shall I discharge this deadly shaft, O sage? As you are my superior, I dare not aim it at you. Hosts of gods had assembled in the sky, seeing the celestial bow drawn in anger by Ram, and fearing that he may destroy the heavens, they cried out, Vishnu, save us, save us! Ram, standing with the bow, blazed as brilliant as the sun, and Parshuram fell back in astonishment. He felt his own power completely eclipsed by Ram. Sudden entity, the sage spoke in faltering tones. You appear invincible, and I can understand that you must surely be the imperishable Vishnu himself. I accept defeat. But I am not shamed, as you are indeed the Lord of all the worlds. Parashuram recalled how Vishnu had long ago said he would come again to take back the divine energy he had given to the sage. The warrior sage folded his palms and said, O Ram, O Almighty One, you have already divested me of my power and my pride. Please release this arrow upon my desires for heavenly pleasures and thereby burn them all to ashes. I only wish to serve you. With all my material aspirations destroyed by you, I shall be fit to become your eternal servant. This is my deepest desire. Parashuram bowed low before Ram, who then fired the fearful shaft. The sage immediately vanished along with the arrow. Then Varuna, the god of the waters, appeared, and Ram gave him the celestial bow to keep on behalf of the gods. The exchange between Ram and the sage was heard and understood only by Vasishta and a few other spiritually powerful Brahmins. The king and the others present had been wholly confounded by the events that had occurred. They were amazed and relieved to see that Ram had somehow appeased the sage. everything again became calm, and the party resumed their journey, soon approaching Ayodhya. Just three before the chapter ends, they make their way back to Ayodhya. Word had already reached Ayodhya of the approach of Dasarath's party. Thousands of Brahmins and citizens had come miles out of the city to greet them. They stood along the wide roads throwing rice grains and fresh green leaves in front of Dasarath. Seated aboard his chariot, the emperor and his sons waved at the people. They moved slowly through the crowds and entered the city in state. It was decorated with flags and festoons and strewn all over with flowers. Trumpet fanfares sounded, and joyous people thronged about the king's party as it went slowly along the main thoroughfare. Dasarath entered his own white marble palace, which resembled Mount Himavat. He was greeted by his wives, who had organized a ceremonious reception for their sons and the new daughters-in-law. After the greeting, the princes and princesses went to their respective palaces and began to enjoy life in Ayodhya, exactly like the gods in heaven. In the last paragraph, after a few weeks, Dasarath asked Bharat and Shatrughna to go to the kingdom of their father-in-law, Kushadvaja, who himself had no sons. The emperor instructed the princes to assist Kushadvaja in the affairs of state. Along with their wives and a large army, Bharata and Shatrughna therefore left the capital and went to Raja Griha, where Kushadvaj lived. End of chapter. So it certainly capsules, not presented. But the encounter between two forms of the Lord, Lord Parashuram and Lord Ram, very interesting. Parashuram is an empowered incarnation, empowered for the purpose of the Lord, of Lord Vishnu, to Vina Chaya Shaduskritam. And Lord Ram approved. But the purpose of his making that ridding of the earth of degraded kings having been fulfilled, then what a nice way to withdraw that power, to have him encounter meeting another king, only in this case it's the personality of Godhead himself. So any comments or discussion? Yes.
What was the purpose of these two incarnations of the Lord coming together in this case, and also why Parashuram could not recognize Sri Ram? They are the same.
Because of his anger. That's what it says here. When what can I say was the purpose of the two lords meeting? The indication is, as I just said, Parashuram was empowered for a specific function, and when that function was completed, to something has to happen so that the function is completed, and the something was that he would meet Lord Ram. And he says, it was Vishnu said, the one who invested him with the power, he would come again. So he came again. And with that coming again, by the drawing of the bow, which was the challenge, that was the sign. So it was to relieve Parashuram of that service and the empowerment and the anger that went with it, because he was in an angry mood. He was in a vengeful mood. The death of his father. Avenging the death of his father. So it had been fulfilled. And so bringing to a conclusion, it's a lila. Then the living entity, who is the empowered Shaktivesh-avatar, is offering his respect to Lord Vishnu. Although in lila he is a Brahmin and Ram is a king, he's explicitly recognizing the divinity of Ram. This is one of these from Brahma Samhita, the Devi Dham, above Devi Dham is Mahesh Dham, above Vish Dham is Hasgoloka Dham. Hari Dham commonly refers to Vaikuntha. Ayodhya is above Vaikuntha in the spiritual hierarchy, but below Goloka in the spiritual hierarchy. So there's in Vaikuntha, there's no question of seeing Narayana anything other than Narayana. Here is seeing the personality of Godhead, Ram, is like a human, but then the members, like the previous section, is Janaka is informing Dasarath of the divinity of his son. And he, just gets carried away with being the father of his son, not the divinity of Ram. And similarly here. So it's a transition. It's not a Vaikuntha pastime. So the pastimes, therefore, are above. The place is above. The intimacy of love is such. But the majesty is still very, very prominent, although human-like. So here's the human-like Ram being honored by the fearful, powerful scourge of the Kshatriyas, Parashuram, facing him with anger. I mean, it's a transcendental lila. But, you're challenging me, give me that bow. And now where should I fire this arrow? And so it's lila, and with that, the power that he was invested with is now withdrawn. So he's now a Brahmin again. It's and the others, the statement is that Dasarath, only Vishwamitra and some of the highly elevated Brahmanas saw and understood the whole thing. Dasarath were just relieved, somehow he pacified and cooled them out. Parashuram. Good going, Ram. So they can't see the divinity. It would spoil the lila. So the nature of the love of the Lord in Ayodhya, or in the transcendental Dham of Ram's lila, is special.
Guru Maharaj, on the same we know that Lord Parshuram is one of the Das avatars, but he is not a Vishnu Tattva. Is that right?
Correct.
He's a Shakti avatar.
Yes.
So he's a Jiva Tattva.
Yeah. Buddha also. Is that right? Okay. Yes. Mataji.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. During the Swayamvara, Ravana saw the powers of Lord Ramachandra when he was lifting. He could lift the bow. Then how could he knows the powers that he was able to break the Shivadanasu, but how come he did that same mistake? Knowing his powers, and he had to take Sita. Was it just a pastime again?
Yes. Yes. Janaka Jans. Yes? You know, the 12 Mahajans. So Janaka knew who was Ram. And he intimated to Dasarath, this isn't just your son. But Dasarath, being the father, had to see his son as a son. There's different realizations, different perceptions according to nature and relationship and Leela and so on. So, the question you asked, it's Leela. And as we look at the Leela, it's simultaneously the Supreme Lord performing Leela. So there's the spirit of chivalry and the spirit of integrity and honesty and virtue and upholding the word of his father and, all of those worldly virtuous things. And then there's the transcendental dimension. At least, two different tracks simultaneously. So it's delightful and mysterious at the same time. But things like you described, that's Leela. In order that so many other glorious activities of Ram could follow, and everything. The kidnapping of Sita, when in fact she wasn't kidnapped, and the feelings of separation, although it was transcendental love, not the worldly feelings of a man losing his beloved wife. Although it looks to worldly people like that, just look at this, henpecked, attached guy. What kind of hero is he? Or whatever people might think. So there's the apparently worldly but actually transcendental aspect. Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, you mentioned that this particular encounter between Lord Ram and Parshuram, only few people were able to understand it.
That's what I just read it.
So, among the devotee channels, whenever we have thought some pastimes of Lord Chaitanya or Lord Ram, how do we understand that pastimes in their true essence?
How do we understand that pastime?
In the true essence.
In the true essence. You need a qualified person to guide you, that's how. Otherwise, you're just, speculating your brains out. You want the true essence, you go to someone who has the true essence. Tadvidhi pranipatina, etc. Need a tattvadarshi, not a good, speculative power. High horsepower speculation, not that. And not even, purity. It's association with a qualified person. So we're completely dependent upon our acharyas. Krishna Das Kaviraj, as learned as he was, his insights were coming from Srup Damodar, who then shared them with Raghunath Das Goswami, who then shared them with the residents of Vrindavan. And then Krishna Das Kaviraj understood them in that way and then conveyed them to us. And in some things, some pastimes, he just said, this remains a great mystery. Isn't it? And just moves on. And if it's a great mystery for him, then how do you understand the true essence? Anything else? Yes? Yes.
Yesterday, there was that discussion about the college student asking this question, misunderstanding the pastime of Lord Ram. So, to such persons, if you say you need a Tattvadarshi to really understand this, and they will say, you know, well, that doesn't make any sense to them, because they don't even know what is a Tattvadarshi, like an ordinary person.
That's okay. That may not make sense to them. It doesn't change the reality. So your question is, how do we convey to somebody the significance of a Tattvadarshi when they don't have a clue what a Tattvadarshi is? That's your question. Well, you try to give them a reasonable explanation, and then they can mull it over. Like anything. You know, they're using their reasoning faculty to understand something that's beyond reasoning. But it's like, this is a classic theological dilemma or dichotomy. Through reason, how we understand those things that are beyond reason, when we're using our reasoning faculty and rely upon it. There are some, so part of reasoning says there are things that are beyond my reasoning faculty. Reasoning tells you that. And then what's the alternative? Well, the alternative is something that's beyond your reasoning faculty. Well, how do you know what that something is that's beyond your reasoning faculty if all you have to work with is your reasoning faculty? And then there's several, just in Bhagavad Gita alone, there's several self-realized soul are described. And there are symptoms. Although I'm using my reasoning faculty and I'm using my senses, there are things that I can see that show the capacity of being beyond reasoning capacity. They're symptoms of a self-realized soul. Tamal Krishna Maharaj wrote a whole, during his finishing of his undergraduate studies at SMU, wrote a book, which is a collection of essays on faith and reason. Exactly, it's a theological question, a classic one. Not only in Christianity or any religion, it's just, how do you get there? You have to use what you have, but the destination is something beyond what you have, and beyond what the faculties can get you. Pantasta koti shadavatsara sampragonya vayor tapi maraso manipungavana. It's the same meaning. By descending mercy. So reasoning says that's the method. So here's this college student, you tell them about a Tattvadarshi, and they can process it however they want to process it. You present it as kindly and as reasonably as possible, and then they'll do what they're going to do with it. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.